Ah, okay. All right. Hey, thanks for showing up tonight and welcome to everybody. Tonight is The Ghost of Canes Part 5. And as I said before, what I was going to do is do some comparison of the Keynesian and the Austrian business cycle theory. Because, they're just polar opposites. You know, the more you read through it, the more you go through stuff, the more you realize that what we're dealing with are two mutually exclusive, mutually exclusive ways of thinking. And obviously the Keynesian theory is winning. I wouldn't even say intellectually, it's winning politically. Because it sees the political system as the savior. And what politician doesn't want to be a savior, right? And so, and understand that the Keynesian position holds, and Keynes himself held that markets did not self-correct, right? That if government did not intervene, then the markets would just collapse, and you'd end up with this equilibrium of high unemployment and low production. Now, obviously, there was the very quick depression of 1921, 1922, the economy recovered quite nicely with that. But be it as it may, you've got to understand that the Keynesian view really does look at the economy is not self-correcting, and very specifically when it's in what they call liquidity trap. And if you've read Krugman, you will see that he constantly talks about interest rates, you know, zero is the lower bound, therefore this is a special case. And he'll keep saying it. So let's go ahead and start the lesson tonight. Of course, as always, if you have questions, comments, whatever, don't be afraid to jump right in. And for those of you who've been taking the quizzes, I do not have it yet ready for last week. I apologize. I will get it done within the next day. All right. So first, let's talk about business cycles. I mean, what are they? You know, some questions. Why do they happen? Can we prevent them? If you're in a downturn, what can be done to bring about recovery? And what should the governments do or not do when a downturn happens, right? And I think you can admit these are the central issues. And understand, that we speak of business cycles, as Rothbard really makes a point in America's Great Depression, we're not talking about business fluctuations. It's a very different thing. Rothbard is very, very clear on that. And he says it's important first to distinguish between business cycles and ordinary business fluctuations, right? And so there would be little small seasonal type cycles and the like, like the harvest loans would be paid in, and so you would have a little bit of action there and there, but that was not the same thing. That was not the business cycle. The seasonal cycle is not the business cycle. But we're talking about really a boom and bust where the economy, man, everybody seems to be doing really, really well. Then all of a sudden, the bottom falls out. What Rothbard says is that, the explanation of the main problem that theory of depression must explain, why is there a sudden general cluster of business errors? I'm reading directly from Rothbard's America's Great Depression, which I have linked and is available to you. That is the very first question for any cycle theory. Business activity moves along nicely with most business firms making handsome profits. Suddenly, without warning, conditions change and the bulk of business firms are experiencing losses. They are suddenly revealed to have made grievous errors in forecasting. And So I think that, and the point that he says is that, you know, that we have a lot of entrepreneurs kind of following a herd and all going down together, which is very different than what happens in a normal economy, right? So first, I want to begin with the Keynesian view, all right? The Keynesian view of the business cycle. And I'm going to adjust one thing over here a second. And I'm using America's Great Depression, and the reason that I'm using it is because it really is a really, really good, it succinctly gives the Austrian business cycle theory, and also it gives you the Keynesian criticisms of it. And I think he does a very good job of explaining the liquidity trap. And so I'm going to depend on Rothbard a lot for this, the things, and likewise for Paul Krugman, because Paul Krugman right now is the major spokesman in the world for the Keynesian viewpoint, right? And now I know we all have difficulties with Krugman, and again, this has not been a class in just Krugmanism or whatever. I mean, it's fun, you know, it's fun to do it. Krugman puts himself out there, and he's a lightning rod, and one has a good time debunking his arguments. But nonetheless, you know, but I use Krugman because, frankly, he states the view so plainly. Now, it's I know there's some little complications, and likewise, being that this is not a course in the general theory. Well, hold on just a second. I'm going to turn my heater off. I know it's getting warm in here. But we had a snow day today for those of you who live in warmer climates, especially those of you down in Auburn. And we did not have classes today, so the offices were kind of cold when we came in. All right. What does Krugman say? Recessions are not necessary consequences of booms. Okay, what he's arguing, yeah, we do have this boom going on. It says they can and should be fought not with austerity but with liberality, the policies that encourage people to spend more, not less. I think this is a very, very important part, because with Krugman, and we went over some of that stuff last week, you know, Krugman, especially on the whole morality play point, and I'm actually quoting from the same article and have it down for required reading, along with Peter Schitt's speech about why the meltdown should not surprise anyone. It was a speech that he gave at the Mises Institute in 2009, but still it's very, very, very good, and I think very, very apropos. The point that Krugman makes is that, in fact, what needs to be done is that the boom needs to continue, right? That there's nothing wrong with the boom. And I think that, again, Keynes argues, and so does Krugman, that a boom is not wasteful. A boom is a good thing. A boom is the economy really going at it, full employment. You want a job, you can get it. And but we're going to point out something, is that the reasons that they happen, and we'll get into the Keynesian causality in just a second, but the reasons that they happen almost are irrelevant, because what you do is you just switch strategy, right? But most important thing is that you just continue to spend and spend and spend. All right. Why does it occur? Okay, now this is Krugman. All right. Recession happens when, for whatever reason, a large part of the private sector tries to increase its cash reserves at the same time. All right, folks, that is what you call paradox of thrift. Okay, I like this, for whatever reason. Now that's all right. Now we know, as you know, those of us following Keynesian theory, we know that Keynes argues that it's investment spending, and I'll be getting to that in a slide in a very short period of time. But I wanted to point out something, though. There is a real lack of cause and effect here. And granted, this is just one statement that he's making, but it's a cause and effect. In other words, that now, for example, how would have you kept the boom going in 2000? All right. Did it occur? All of a sudden, people just started saving. You know, the Fed raised interest rates. Okay, did that mean that people now they want to start saving, and all of a sudden everybody starts increasing its cash reserves? Or was the collapse of the stock market, you know, that bubble, did that might have something to do with it? When, you know, when companies were just being overvalued out the wazoo. And Schiff deals with that in his talk. Again, I really, you know, spend about an hour and listen to it. Or if you have good internet, which I do not at home, I have used that. That's not good internet. It's a satellite. But it's because I live in the country, all right. But again, look at we look at what Krugman is saying, right? That it just suddenly happens. Okay. Now that's I'll tell you what, that's not an economic theory. It's he's you know, and I need to be careful in fairness to him about pulling out stray phrases and jumping all over them. But nonetheless, I think that someone of his stature needs to be careful when he says, well, for whatever reason, okay, gee, well, what would the reason be? Okay, and this is something else. Okay, what causes the increase in demand for money? Okay, well, it's invest demand, decline in investment demand. Okay, the key is, and this is Krugman writing again. In fact, the key to the Keynesian revolution in economic thought, a revolution that made hangover theory in general and Austrian theory in particular is obsolete as epicycles, was John Maynard Keynes' realization. The crucial question was not why investment demand sometimes declines, but why such declines cause the whole economy to slump. All right. And so, in other words, what would happen? Well, Keynes argued that there was a multiplier effect in investment spending. And so when the animal spirits are up, then the people that they whatever they spend, it's multiplied throughout the economy, and that you have this multiplier, and you can even mathematically calculate it, and the multiplier will revert, you know, reverberate throughout the economy and really make things good. Okay, now that's when the animal spirits are up, but he argues up. But their animal spirits may be down as well, okay? And in other words, that they're not really particularly rational so much. They just have wild swings in their spending, and they're up and they're down. And I suspect that anybody who's ever spent some time doing day trading may, you know, say, my gosh, I think maybe I agree with them. I've never done day trading, but I've talked to people who have. And they say it could be really a pretty wild experience. And so, but nonetheless, the day trading does not make a whole lot of investments cycle. But this is Keynes' argument that you have a decrease in investment spending brought about by changes in the animal spirits of the investors, and that brings down investment spending, which in turn triggers this paradox of thrift, that people start getting nervous, the multipliers, now people start getting nervous, they stop spending and they save, and there's no guarantee that these savings will be converted into investment, so therefore the economy goes down. I'm trying to avoid my coughing spells this time, all right? So I have a little bit of green tea. Hopefully that'll keep me going for a while. All right, how's the downturn reversed? Now, this is also important to understanding the Keynesian view and also how why it's so popular. In most situations, the Keynesians advocate a policy of easy money. Truth is, actually, they always advocate easy money. All right, push down interest rates. You know, Keynes believed that the market set interest rates too high and the government should come in. Government should be in charge of investment. Government should have just a huge hold on the economy. All right, you know, if anybody says, well, Keynes is saving capitalism or saving free enterprise, it's nonsense. But nonetheless, all right, the idea is this, though. In normal times, there's a downturn, and if you cut interest rates, it's going to spur more investment spending and thus result in more consumer spending, which Keynesians will then hope, you know, reverse and turn into a boom, okay? But what happens if the boom goes boom? Ah, all right. Well, what they call this is the Keynesian case. All right, and it's the liquidity trap. Now, I suspect that all of you watching are familiar with that term. You've probably read it. You want to know what the liquidity trap is. And again, I will say that Krugman probably single-handedly brought back that concept. In all the years that, you know, 30 plus years that I've been interested in economics and was reading, you know, economists, and this is even long before I got my PhD, I was familiar with the Keynesian concept of the liquidity trap. I had it in graduate school, and, you know, in fact, I had my master's studies as well, but what I'd never heard anybody invoke it. He certainly couldn't invoke it in 1982 because interest rates were in double digits. And so, and in fact, there was this belief that the higher interest rates were causing the downturn. All right, and that was the popular wisdom of the times. And I remember the Atlanta Constitution having an editorial attacking there's actually Gene Tharp, their economics correspondent, and he attacked Reagan as you know, being cruel because he wouldn't lower interest rates and put the economy back to work. And, you know, why he apparently must be protecting his rich friends because his rich friends are getting high interest rates. And so that's what was happening. All right. But I'm going to explain, though, the special Keynesian case. In other words, there are times when, hey, all you got to do is cut interest rates, get that easy money back in the economy, get investment going again. If you have inflation, don't worry about it. Inflation is actually cutting wages and thus making, you know, full employment a reality. But what happens if interest rates are about zero? And what Krugman is very, very fond of saying, you know, zero is being the lower bound. All right, what happens? Well, according to Keynesians, the economy will move into a liquidity trap. All right, now what do we mean by that? Liquidity trap? All right. Well, I'm going to use Rothbard here to explain it. It says Keynesians claim that liquidity preference or demand for money may be so persistently high that the rate of interest could not fall low enough to stimulate investment sufficiently to raise the economy out of the depression. All right. In other words, that monetary policy won't work. Whatever, you know, and this is still for whatever reason, right? That Krugman says, all of a sudden you've got this demand for money, which is, you know, that people want to have it. If demand for money increases, of course, prices are going to fall. or you're going to have a situation of falling prices, but you're going to have more money going into savings, right? And so people want to hold money, and whereas Krugman really believes that they're hoarding it, and certainly Keynes believed it as well, that what we really were dealing with was a hoard of money, not just a situation of people just saving a little bit too much. They're hoarding money. Okay, that has a really bad sound, doesn't it? You know, it makes you think of Silas Marner, okay, in a room, and he's got all this money. He's a miser, and he's got this money, and he won't spend it. My gosh, he just holds on to it, and it's not doing anybody any good, right? And so, therefore, this is the view. So people are hoarding money, and they're not spending. And because they're not spending, the economy is in the tank. And cutting interest rates won't help. Why? Because then people will continue to hoard it because they think interest rates are going to go back up. All right? So what can you do? Oh, my gosh. Okay, this is we're in a liquidity problem. And I remember a few years ago, I went to a conference in New York. It was the Federal Reserve in the 21st century. And, I went, and it was at the New York Fed, and so there I was in the auditorium and in the halls that Benjamin Strong once strode through, and Reed Rothbard on Benjamin Strong, and of course had the Fed's food, which is pretty good. Fed actually fed us well, but we had a session, and an economist from Dartmouth went to the microphone. Now, you got to understand, I never did go to the microphone because I figured I would probably be thrown over a balcony or something if I actually said something about the Austrians. And so I sat back and just listened and whatnot. But this economist from Dartmouth went up, and he said to them, "When are you going to recognize that we're in a liquidity trap?" All right, so yeah, we are in a liquidity trap. What's the Fed going to do? Because the whole time, we're being treated to all these lectures in which the Fed was explaining how it can increase aggregate demand, because everybody knows that aggregate demand needs to go up. All right. Ooh. All right, I don't know what happened. I think I was putting extra, I would have blank slides. I'm afraid number 11 is just a blank slide. I apologize for that. Okay, now why? All right. Rothbard again. Okay, in their stress on the liquidity trap as a potent factor in aggravating depression and perpetuating unemployment, the Keynesians make much fuss over the alleged fact that people in a financial crisis expect a rise in the rate of interest, and therefore will hoard money instead of purchasing bonds and contributing toward lower rates. It is this speculative hoard that constitutes the liquidity trap and is supposed to indicate the relation between liquidity preference and the interest rate. Now, what does that mean? Okay. First thing to keep in mind, okay, that and Rothbard, and I don't have this in my slides, but Rothbard makes the point about explaining interest and where the Keynesians are wrong. But nonetheless, the idea of liquidity trap, money is trapped, all right, people really are, it's part of this fallacy of composition, right? Something that's good for one person then will be good for everybody else. But you see that when saving, it's good for one person maybe to do it. But if everybody saves, then what you have is an economy that's imploding. So the first thing to keep in mind is that in the Keynesian view, interest comes about because of liquidity preference. All right, Keynes argued that interest rates were, quote, a reward for parting with liquidity, unquote. All right, so in other words, his view of interest is that people will only part with liquidity if they can get a better rate of interest. So we've got to find some way to get this hoard of money out of the system. How are we going to do it? And of course, there are different ways. I mean, Keynes had his balanced budget multiplier. You know, you raise taxes, which stimulates the economy. I know that elsewhere, you know, they talk about in the Keynesian view, raise taxes, that hurts it. But I remember in grad school doing, of course, the balanced budget multiplier, which the idea was this, that government would spend 100% of the money, whereas a person would have a propensity to save some of it. And so if you took that dollar, you spent it, which would, of course, would then stimulate the economy, all right? And we hear that term stimulus a lot, don't we? You know, the Keynesian, you know, the argument here, this is what Rothbard writes. He says, he talks about the liquidity trap, okay? All right, and I'm going to read from America's Great Depression, because I think this is important. Again, and Rothbard, look, even though Rothbard is challenging the Keynesian theory, I believe he's presenting it honestly, right? In fact, when I read Rothbard, read Krugman's criticism of the Austrian theory, you know, you can see almost that they're both saying the same thing, but Krugman is reaching different conclusions. Talked about that statement I read before. This statement assumes that the rate of interest is determined by liquidity preference instead of by time preference. Now, I want to stop here, ask, are all of you familiar with the Austrian view on interest, on time preference? I mean, it's absolutely vital to understand that, to understand the Austrian business cycle theory. But do any of you not understand? I guess that's a better question to ask. Does anybody not understand it or has not been exposed to it? And I can explain it right now. So if I don't get a question, I'm going to assume that everybody, in fact, does understand it. And I don't see my Q&A bar lighting up. And so I'm going to assume that everybody understands that point. So I'm going to go back to reading Rothbard again. I think this is important. It also assumes that the link between savings and investment is very tenuous indeed, only tentatively exerting itself through the rate of interest. But on the contrary, it is not a question of saving and investment being acted upon by the rate of interest. In fact, saving, investment, and the rate of interest are each and all simultaneously determined by individual time preferences on the market. Liquidity preference has nothing to do with this matter. Keynesians maintain that if the speculative demand for cash rises in a depression, this will raise the rate of interest. But this is not at all necessary. Increased hoarding can come about either from funds formerly consumed, from funds formerly invested, or from a mixture of both that leaves the old consumption investment proportion unchanged. Unless time preferences change, the last alternative will be the one adopted. Thus, if the rate of interest depends solely upon time preference and not at all liquidity preference, in fact, if the increased hoards come mainly out of consumption with increased demand for money, an increased demand for money will cause interest rates to fall because time preferences have fallen. Now, this is important. Again, I think that we understand that in the Austrian view, that time preference is going to determine the rate of interest, and the rate of interest is going to send a signal to entrepreneurs, right, that the about the length of their investment strategies. And when I mean length, I'm talking about the length of production and all of the capital deepening and all the things that, that occur with, you know, in these situations. So, all right, want to go keep going. Okay. All right. What does it mean? All right. Now writes Krugman. Okay. And that's where people hoard their money, don't spend it, writes Krugman. From the beginning, it was, or at least should have been obvious that the financial crisis had plunged us into a liquidity trap situation in which many people figure they might just as well sit on cash. America spent most of the 1930s in a liquidity trap. Japan has been one since the mid-1990s, and we're in one now. Right? Again, so this is, it's Krugman writing in the last few years. Actually, this was from an article he wrote, column he wrote earlier this year entitled Not Enough Inflation. So, at any rate, that's Krugman's view. We just don't have enough inflation. That's our problem. If we had more inflation, then things would be hunky-dory. All right. Krugman on liquidity trap. Krugman continues, economists who had studied such traps, a group that included Ben Bernanke and, well, me, knew that some of the usual rules of economics are in abeyance as long as the trap lasts. Budget deficits, for example, don't drive up interest rates. Printing money isn't inflationary. Slashing government spending really has really destructive effects on incomes and employment. All right, now I emphasize that. Okay, because I think that we have to keep in mind that when Krugman is talking about the rules of economics, he's trying to do so in a macro sense, but unwittingly what he's really doing is saying that opportunity cost is also suspended. And that is, if you know that in an opportunity cost that, that all actions, we rank our actions, whatever they do in terms of preference. And so your opportunity cost is that next highest preference that you gave up in order to do a certain action. All right. And to a certain extent, what he's saying is, that if you have a lot of idle resources, then all bets are off because you can stimulate employment of these idle resources, whether it be employment, whether it be capital, mining, whatever, that you can stimulate employment simply by pushing money into the economy. All right, I'm going to turn this thing back on. Chilly in here. All right. He's back. All right. So, Krugman is writing that, and that Bernanke believes it, okay, that once you get in a liquidity trap, now your the rules are changed. And that's some of the things he's talking about. And why is he so adamant regarding government spending? I think this is important to keep in mind. Okay. Keynesians are going to argue that because you're idle resources, it's almost costless for government to lead the way out. Okay, interest rates are low, government borrows a lot of money. And second, it's spend it lavishly on anything but spend. All right, and government should up their spend. Krugman argues that we're really an austerity program because we have not vastly increased spending since 2008. In other words, and we talked about that last week, right? Remember the $400 billion difference. If only we had spent $1.2 trillion instead of $800 million, then we'd be out of the thing. That it was just a lack of vision on the part of Obama. And of course, I had this blog. I haven't written on it for a while for other reasons. Yeah, hold on just a second. All right, my daughter is here to you. Okay, you have a good time. Yeah. Go ahead and get close to the door. Thanks, Cynthia. Yeah. All right, bye-bye, sweetheart. So, you know, so what they argue, you know, it says spend on something. Why? Because people are hoarding money, okay? And government has not only, you know, would of course be some of these hoards, especially rich people. That's why Krugman is arguing, and by the way, Robert Reich. Now, this Robert Reich is arguing he's an underconsumptionist, and Krugman is not quite willing to openly endorse that, at least not yet. But Robert Reich is saying, why is the economy bad? Because we're not taxing the rich enough. If only we had 70, 80, 90% tax rates, if we had those rates, then the economy would be booming, all right? And so that's why, because rich people just won't spend. I'm going to close my office door. So the you've got, and so what happens, all right, borrow massive amounts of money, and so increase the debt. And in fact, that's, if you look at what's happened, certainly the Obama administration has increased the debt, although Krugman argues most of that is because of the recession, because government taxes are down, and so, but government still is on an austerity plan. It likes to say Barack Obama's on an austerity plan. And somehow, and I used to argue in my blog that, you know, Krugman would have the Republicans, they were Goldstein, it was like Goldstein, you know, Emanuel Goldstein in the book 1984. Yeah, anything happened, well, it's Goldstein that did it. Well, understand that there were 60 Democrats in the U.S. Senate during the first 2 years of Obama's term, and the House of Representatives was overwhelmingly Democrat, all right? And so the Democrats had a filibuster-proof majority, which is how they got Obamacare. I mean, Obamacare came through because only Democrats voted on it, but there were enough Democrats to be able to push it through. There was no filibuster on it. So I'm not sure how the Republican Party could have stopped, but what Krugman argues is just even arguing, even making the point that a vast increase in government spending might be a bad thing is enough. Just making the argument makes you an enemy of the people and makes you responsible for all the misery. I kid you not. That's just how the guy has been saying things. But nonetheless, the idea is borrow, go into debt, no problem. Why? And I don't have this on my slide, but why is the debt not a problem? Can anybody tell me why that? In the Keynesian view, the debt is not a problem, at least current levels. Current levels are never a problem. It could be in the future, okay? But and if anybody in this audience explain to me why the Keynesians are arguing that lots of debt really doesn't matter. All right. Well, yeah. Nobody has a comment. No, not the multiplier. It's completely illogical. But why is it that they argue? Okay. All right. Why is it they argue? We owe it all to ourselves. How many times have you heard that? We owe it all to ourselves. Yeah, in the long run, we're all dead. That was another thing. And there we go. We owe it to ourselves. I don't cite logic. Yeah, inflate it away. We can always inflate. In fact, inflation is a good thing because it deleverages debt. All right. And so, and Krugman argues that inflation actually gives us a wealth transfer from the rich to the poor, all right? And so, therefore, if you're against inflation, you're a racist, you're a classist, you're evil. You want people to suffer. And so that's the thing, that we have to have more and more we've got to have that, you know, more and more inflation, okay? And we can always control it. And if it gets too big, you know, but then we can, you know, maybe cut back a little bit. All right. Yeah, Ward, you've got a good point. Did they, the Keynesians, what do they do? They point to World War II, don't they? They say, look at World War II. What an incredible stimulus it was. And the economy went from being with high unemployment, double-digit unemployment, to, you know, 1.4%, which, you know, really means that there were lots and lots and lots of job openings that could not be filled. And all I can say is Robert Higgs did a very, very good job. 1992 paper in the Journal of Economic History. And he took another view outside the Keynesian view of World War II and the home front. And of course, what he points out is just what a hard life people had at home, and we forget that. I mean, everything was in short supply. And so you would not have anything at all that would enable you to look at World War II. I mean, and say, well, what a great, you know, the best years of our lives, economically speaking. People talk about, you know, during that time, yeah, people pulling together and all that. And to a certain extent, even following the rules, you know, all the blackouts in the houses and when your lights had to be out and the like. And so people got the sense that they were sacrificing for a purpose. Okay. But, you know, you would have these social gatherings where women would wrap bandages and things like that. And so you would always, you know, so you had that. But in terms, economically speaking, I mean, you look at what was being produced, bombs, bullets, guns, things that were materials. People do not like to consume those materials. I do not think that the people of Hiroshima appreciated being the consumers of the atomic bomb. And so what we're, you know, that, we're talking about a whole list of goods that are just war goods, all right? And, I agree with you on that word. We all owe it to ourselves. So I'm just saying that's what Krugman is arguing. And, thank you, Cam. Cam, you're always on top of stuff. I really appreciate that. And I would recommend that you read Robert Higgs on that. But the idea here with the Keynesians, though, okay, you think of an economy, the government starts spending. What do they spend it on? Well, about anything they can. I mean, it's just now Krugman argues, okay, it's not good to throw money out of the helicopter. Why is it not good to throw money out of the helicopter? Because people might save it. If you give them money directly, they're going to save it. They're going to pay off debts. They're going to do things like that. Stuff that we, problems that we, you know, that we're, you know, it's going to cause a problem because they'll save it. So government needs to be the main entity in spending. All right, and it's always things like public works, right? I mean, that's the first thing we hear every time. Okay, a question. And then watch, right, long run, we're all dead. Yep, exactly right. Except, of course, that, you know, that I have to look at America of the future with, you know, my own children and grandchildren. My grandchildren are substantially younger than I am, And so, I mean, it's not like there will be, you know, there's going to be a time when all this stuff really comes to fruition. Not a good thing. Well, but in the Keynesian view, again, the spending will start spreading. Government spends and then you get this multiplier effect. And ultimately, if you spend enough money, the economy by itself, all right, as Krugman likes to say, gains traction and starts moving by itself, that all of these resources become employed again. The reason, okay, and this is important, all right, this is a real important distinction between the Austrians and the Keynesians. Keynesians hold that idle resources are the result, you know, in other words, unemployment of resources are the simple result of not enough aggregate demand. Raise aggregate demand, this problem takes care of itself. Austrians, on the other hand, argue that a lot of unemployed resources are unemployed for a reason. They were not sustainable, that the boom ran aground on its own. The boom did not end because people all of a sudden stopped spending or got scared. The boom ended because, number one, you would have inflation starting to come up, but also the boom ends because it becomes apparent to the owners of the factors of production that are involved in these businesses that are feeding the boom, that it is quite apparent that these investments cannot be profitable. All right. And I think that is, you know, something that's very, very important to keep in mind. So I think that the Keynesian view, the boom runs aground because people start hoarding money, or maybe investors get scared, or something happens, and all of a sudden the spending stops, and that this boom could have continued. All right. Austrians argue that these booms tend to run aground because it becomes quite apparent that these investments that have been fed by easy money and by whatever government policies cannot be sustained. That's the problem, all right? And we'll talk, I do want to talk about the housing situation, but obviously want to go on. Okay, what about the Austrians, okay? Now, you know, I point out, I do use Rothbard, even though I know Mises and Hayek wrote on it. Rothbard is very, very succinct, okay? And he writes for, you know, educated audiences, general audiences, okay? It's his prose, I mean, Mises wrote pretty clearly. I think, you know, now I don't think Mises is this dense, per se. Hayek is a lot more dense. But I think Rothbard really has captured the essence of the theory. And so I think that, you know, that when he says that, I'm going back on Rothbard on business cycles, and I'm going to spend some time with that, and, you know, we'll kind of mop up. But what is it that Rothbard is saying? All right. The problem of the business cycle is one of a general boom and depression. It's not a problem of exploring specific industries and wondering what factors make each one of them relatively prosperous or depressed. All right. That, and yet, as we all know, that in fact, that we're going to see certain sectors getting hit first. All right. See, one of the things that Krugman and the Keynesians argue is that everybody declines together, that all of a sudden we have a general malaise, that it doesn't matter capital goods, consumer goods, whatnot, that in fact everybody gets hit pretty much the same, and so the levels of unemployment are going to be about the same no matter what the kind of industry. Which really is not true. I mean, if you look at different types of investment level, you know, I mean, unemployment levels for different industries, you see a much different picture, right? Okay, again, and talk about the cluster of errors with Rothbard. The main theory, the problem that a theory of depression must explain is why is there a sudden general cluster of business errors? This is the first question for any cycle theory. Business activity moves along nicely with most business firms making handsome profits. And suddenly, without warning, conditions change and the bulk of business firms are experiencing losses. They are suddenly revealed to have made grievous errors in forecasting. Okay, that's important. All right. And so it's, you know, that it was Mises that argued the first explained in Theory of Money and Credit, which he wrote in 1912, about the general boom and bust cycle. And if you remember that, you know, that we talked about, and it was in my paper in, okay, let me see something, second. All right. Okay, it's good. All right, appreciate it. I'm just looking at some of the comments real quickly. Chat comments, because I saw one up there that I've not answered. Yeah. All right, thanks. And something else, though, that this is a general theory, okay, and the it's a general theory that says, okay, this is what causes the boom. This is why the bust occurred. And you can apply it in business cycles, okay? The Keynesians do try to be a little more specific. For example, if you say, hey, what about the Depression of 1921? Why was that not, why was there not a recovery there? And they will argue, well, you didn't have a financial crisis that time, and so it was centered elsewhere. But the Great Depression, you had a financial crisis in 1929, 1930, and likewise in 2008, you had a financial crisis, and so it's different because it takes the economy longer to recover from a financial crisis. That's a Keynesian view. Now, I think it was also very, very important to keep in mind that Obama became president in 2009 and the financial crisis had just occurred the previous fall. And so Krugman was in some ways making excuses for Obama, which, of course, he likes to tend to do. All right, you know, some comments there. And make sure, like I said, you read the chat comments. I don't want to get, unless it's really, really specifically tied to what I'm saying, I'm going to let you guys read among yourselves. So it's, okay, the cycle, it's, you've got a government-induced boom. Okay, leads the economy into lines of production that cannot be sustained. Okay, and you got a lot of the boom finance, frankly, borrowed money. Let me give you an example of a boom and bust situation that occurred in around Texas and Oklahoma. And I remember in the Ronald Reagan was president. Remember, he was elected in 1980. And so, I mean, and his being in the White House, it was interesting. Just somebody who supposedly thought like him, and believe me, I mean, Reagan was a lot more liberal, I think, than people would admit, especially on the spending side. But nonetheless, in their minds, they couldn't even conceive of somebody being there. So they kept. So the economic news was always bad. All right, and they media saw no reason to try to protect them. All right, the way they are protecting our president, the present guy in the White House. All right, but. But what happened in Texas and Oklahoma? Remember, oil prices were deregulated. Finally, they had been doing it by step. They finally were deregulated in 1981, February of 1981 to be exact. And everybody expected oil prices to go up. The idea, the thinking was this, that the only reason they're not higher in the United States is because the government is holding down the prices. Once the government is going, unleashes that, the oil companies, prices are going to go up substantially. I remember one of Ralph Nader's acolytes claimed that by 1990, oil prices could be at $600 a barrel. I mean, you know, where do people get this stuff? But this is the mentality. But what was going on in Texas, all right? So there was a big rush for, you know, to invest, okay, in oil fields, and oil companies were getting a lot of new money, okay? And likewise, people were assuming, okay, now we're going to have an oil boom. We're going to have people moving. So they started building new housing projects or, you know, housing developments, not probably the housing development, and especially concentrated in Oklahoma and Texas, where there was going to be a lot of activity. Well, we know what happened. Oil prices didn't go up. They went down during the 1980s, and down not only in real terms, but even in nominal terms. I remember in around 1985 or so that for a while it got to around $10 a barrel. I mean, there were really there were oil prices just for a short time, okay? But oil prices were falling, okay? What did that mean, okay? It meant that these industries were not profitable. They were letting go a number of people. And so places like Houston, Texas, which had experienced all this boom money, suddenly became towns that were, you know, people were hurting. People were walking away from homes, okay? It was kind of like what we saw in 2008, 2009 and beyond. We saw this on a really large scale, all right? Yep. If you don't have an oil well, get one, okay? Activity, but yeah, you could just exactly right. And even, but even so, oil prices fell. And what was driving that was not simply just lower interest rates, but also the belief that oil prices were going to go up. And I remember in 1983, I think around September of 83, a hurricane came through and did some damage. And Houston had a lot of those glass boxes. And so there were a lot of broken windows and a lot of glass all over the place. And so USA Today had an article talking about the silver lining in this, because now all this money is going to be spent to repair the damage in Houston. And yeah, you got a kick out of that. Wow, this is great, man. The broken window theory here, you know, this Bastiat lives. Well, it was kind of like a mini situation, all right? The rest of the country, of course, the rest of us were doing quite well with low oil prices. But nonetheless, that what you have this boom is it cannot stay as is, okay? And Rothbard on the cause, okay, a boom and bust. In the purely free and unhampered market, there will be no cluster of errors, since trained entrepreneurs will not all make errors at the same time. The boom bust cycle is generated by monetary intervention in the market, specifically bank credit expansion to business. All right. It says, now, what happens when banks print new money, or whether it's bank notes or bank deposits, and lend it to business? The new money pours forth on the loan market, lowers the loan rate of interest. It looks as if the supply of saved funds for investment has increased, where the effect is the same. The supply of funds for investment apparently increases, and the interest rate is lowered. Businessmen, in short, are misled by the bank inflation into believing that the supply of saved funds is greater than it really is. Now, why is that important? It's important because what we're dealing with are time, you know, is a time preference view of interest, okay? And so it makes it look like people are saving, so they're going to consume less. And so what you have are these longer term investments that are going to be fed by all of this newly saved money, except it's not newly saved money. So it's now, Rothbard goes on, now when saved funds increase, businessmen invest in longer processes of production, such as the capital structure is lengthened, especially in the higher orders, okay, most removed from the consumer. And what he talks about, the higher order, this is what Carl Menger had in his Principles of Economics that he wrote in 1871. And he talks about goods being of higher order. That is that these are goods used in the production of other higher order goods, and the process goes on all the way until you have the consumer goods, okay? And the consumer goods are the goods of the lowest order, and the capital goods and the like are goods of higher, you know, orders, okay? And what happens is that because there will not be as much consumption now, they take away from, you know, the investment shifts from just the making of consumer goods to making the, you know, to lengthening this capital structure. Now, this is going to mean capital deepening. This will be an improved consumer goods in the future, right? And so in sum, businessmen were misled by bank credit inflation to invest too much in higher order capital goods, which could only be prosperously sustained through lower time preferences and save greater savings and investment. As soon as the inflation permeates to the mass of the people, the old consumption investment proportion is reestablished and business investments in the higher orders are seen to have been wasted. Okay, that's pretty much the Austrian theory in a nutshell. I'm going to go on just a little bit more. Okay. The boom, then, is actually a period of wasteful misinvestment, or what you might call malinvestment. And it is a time when errors are made due to bank credits tampering with the free market. The crisis arrives when the consumers come to reestablish their desired proportions. The depression is actually the process by which the economy adjusts to the waste and errors of the boom and reestablishes efficient service of consumer desires. The adjustment process consists in rapid liquidation of the wasteful investments. Some of these will be abandoned altogether, like the Western ghost town constructed in the boom of 1868-18, deserted during the Panic of 1819. Others will be shifted to other uses. And I'm going to get to some current thinking on this too, all right? And especially I'd like to talk about the housing boom, okay? But in sum, the free market tends to satisfy the voluntarily expressed consumer desires with maximum efficiency. And this includes the public's relative desires for present and future consumption. The inflationary boom hobbles this efficiency and distorts the structure of production, and it no longer serves consumers properly. The crisis signals the end of this inflationary distortion, and the depression is the process by which the economy returns to the efficient service of consumers. Okay. Now, in short, and this is a highly important point to grasp, the depression is the recovery process, and the end of the depression heralds a return to normal and to optimum efficiency. Depression, then, far from being an evil scourge, is the necessary and beneficial return of the economy to normal after the distortions imposed by the boom. The boom, then, requires a bust. All right, this is really, and I think this is really important. And it's, by the way, it's the stuff that drives Keynesians crazy. Keynesians like Krugman, okay, which as powerful as these seductions may be, talking about the hangover theory, the Austrian theory, they must be resisted, for the hangover theory is disastrously wrong-headed. Recessions are not necessary consequences of booms. They can and should be fought not with austerity but with liberality, with policies that encourage people to spend more, not less. Okay, we can read. Nor is this merely an academic argument. Hangover theory can do real harm. Liquidationist views played an important part in the spread of the Great Depression, with Austrian theorists such as Friedrich von Hayek and Joseph Schumpeter strenuously arguing in the very depths of the Depression against any attempt to restore sham prosperity by expanding credit and the money supply. These same views are doing their bit to inhibit recovery in the world's depressed economies at this very moment. Now, this is important because, you know, of course, this assumes that the Austrian theory was somehow being widely accepted by politicians in the United States and elsewhere, which, you know, let's face it, folks, that's a joke. I mean, that politicians aren't going to accept this at all. And nobody in any position of authority. Ben Bernanke, and by the way, when you talk about the liquidations, what they're really talking about is the quote from, the alleged quote from Andrew Mellon, who was Secretary of the Treasury, and how he supposedly told President Herbert Hoover, said, liquidate the farmers, you know, liquidate, he said, purge the rottenness from the system. Okay. And so, therefore, because he allegedly said those words, therefore, the Hoover government pursued austerity. I mean, this is just a nonsense. And in fact, Herbert Hoover argues in his book that he did everything to avoid Mellon's advice, that they did not follow that line of action. All right. And so, again, what are they saying, though? The liquidationists, what are they saying? They say, if you do this, the economy will never recover. We will go back because the economy cannot self-correct. It'll spiral downward into that equilibrium that Keynes talks about of depression, okay, and permanent depression, all right, high unemployment. In other words, people will not do what's good for them. People will not, you know, that you'll be in this, I guess what you would call a Nash equilibrium, if you remember the Nash equilibrium, okay, from economic studies and from game theory. Okay, keep going. Thus, banks' credit expansion sets into motion the business cycle in all its phases. The inflationary boom, marked by expansion of the money supply and by malinvestment, the crisis which arrives when credit expansion ceases and malinvestments become evident. In the depression recovery, the necessary adjustment processes by which the economy returns in most efficient ways of satisfying consumer desires. That's the sum of it. All right, now this is another point, too, that Rothbard makes. Since factors must shift from the higher to the lower orders of production, there is an inevitable frictional unemployment and depression, but it need not be greater than unemployment attending any other large shift in production. All right. Because I'm looking for, you know, Krugman says, all right, here it is. So if people decide to spend less on investment goods, doesn't that mean they decide to spend more on consumption goods, implying that investment slump should always be accompanied by a corresponding consumption boom? And if so, why should there be a rise in unemployment? Modern hangover theorists probably don't even realize this is a problem for their story. Nor did those supposedly deep Austrian theorists answer the riddle. The best that von Hayek or Schumpeter could come up with was the vague suggestion that unemployment was a frictional problem created as the economy transferred workers from the bloated investment sector back to the production of consumer goods. Right. Hence our opposition to any attempt to increase demand. This would leave part of the work of the Depression undone, since mass unemployment was part of the process adapting the structure of production. All right. Oh, okay. Now you see what he's saying. All right. Where in Rothbard, where do we see we have to have mass unemployment? You don't. All right. What Rothbard is saying is that if the government allows the adjustment to occur, you will in fact see the shifts, all right? And an unemployment will progress beyond the frictional stage and become really severe and lasting only if wage rates are kept artificially high and are prevented from falling. Okay. If wage rates are kept above the free market level that clears the demand for and supply of labor, laborers will remain permanently unemployed. The greater the degree of discrepancy, the more severe the unemployment will be. That's certainly true. I can say that certainly is true. But notice that what Rothbard is saying then is it's not the recession itself that creates mass unemployment over time, but rather the intervention. All right? Well, do you see where the Keynesians are saying no? It's the lack of intervention. And what, and part of the myth, and I think that reading Rothbard's America's Great Depression is a really good myth-busting book, because by the way, it ends with Hoover. He didn't even go into the New Deal in that book, right? It's not a book about the New Deal. It's a book about, about the Hoover presidency, and we call it the Hoover New Deal. But he points out all of the intervention that the Hoover administration made in the markets time and again, right? And that was in 1929, when you didn't have all of these jillion agencies, right, and all these federal workers to support all this huge. You did not have this gargantuan sector of totally unproductive people and lines of work that are totally unproductive. You did not have anything like that. You think about what's going on now, whereas you have people in private profit-making industry having to work in order to support the rest of the economy, the government and whatnot. And think about it. The rest of the country, for the most part, has become poor in the last 5 years, but the counties around Washington, D.C. have boomed. That should tell you something, that what we're dealing with is a real transfer of wealth, not a stimulus helping the economy. We're talking about a major transfer of wealth. And so I think that's important to keep in mind. I want to talk about the housing bubble and the collapse and why it still affects us, right? And one thing is that did it follow the Austrian theory? Well, one thing you would have had certainly a development in capital goods, but a home is actually a very, very large durable good, okay, which is going to require a lot of capital investment. It's going to require a lot of higher orders of production, okay? And you had that. How was it that all this money became available? It wasn't just the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, and although they did lower them. It was also the presence of these government-created entities, Freddie and Fannie, okay, that both of these were, what they would do was they would purchase mortgages from banks. Now, lending institutions, they would purchase them for the present value, and then that cash that they would generate would go back into the system, into the mortgage system. So, in other words, you had this circular flow, as it were. All right, and plus the fact that you have all of these government agencies. You've got FHA, you've got VA loan, you've got all of these entities that are pushing housing. All right, the government was not neutral on housing. You talk to real estate lawyers, and they will tell you that they were told, hey, you approve everybody, including these subprime people, okay? Now, granted, the subprime, it wasn't Freddie and Fannie that created the subprime securities. It was actually firms on Wall Street. But why would Wall Street do it? They did it because the Fed was constantly saying, we will back you up. If you screw up, We will be there. We've got your back. We will take care of you. All right. And you think about that. I mean, that, and so, and by the way, by about 2004, 2005, it should have been obvious. Okay. In a lot of places like California, now some places got hit much worse than others. All right. But in California, I think half to maybe by 2005, half to maybe two-thirds of the mortgages were interest only. That should have been, okay, what was going on? All right. Well, you start seeing the pressures of all this money coming in. Housing prices were going up. And as Schiff talks about in the speech, he says, look, he says that the proxy, which would be rents versus what you would do for house payment, that house payments were substantially higher. That you should have known that, in fact, things were getting out of hand. It's like, you know, these some of these price earnings ratios in 1999 were near infinity because they didn't have any profit. So, you know, and you know, the price to earnings, or whether it's earnings were zero. Okay, so you know, you had this infinite ratio. And so the things, in other words, it was obvious, should have been obvious that things were getting out of hand. And so you think of all huge amounts of money pouring into that. And when it finally broke up, you see, and what broke it up? What broke it up was the fact that it could not be sustained. The higher the prices, you could no longer put people into houses. People were buying houses, and then they were end up defaulting because the payments were just too high. They couldn't make the payments. It was that simple. And so I think that there was no way the government could have continued this boom. Why? Because housing prices were going up much faster than income. And so how in the world, what would the government be able to do? They cannot create something out of nothing, no matter what Krugman may say. That it could not have been sustained. This boom, which was based upon housing and all of the spending and all the, you know, that, let me give you another example. People were refinancing their mortgages, right? Interest rates would fall. And so what were they doing? They were refinancing their mortgages. They were now getting lower house payments. They would borrow a big sum of money, whatever. They might buy a new car. They might buy whatever. And they could just roll those payments. Not only that, those payments were, you know, the interest was tax deductible because it was mortgage. I remember they developed a credit card based on your equity and in your house. And I remember we used to have a billboard on when I would drive to work. It's like around 2004, maybe to about 2006 or so. This year, take the vacation on the house, all right? In other words, hey, borrow against your equity, take a loan, take a vacation, really treat yourself. In fact, if you're lucky, maybe you can even refinance your mortgage, drive your payments down even farther, all right? And so this could not be sustained. I think this is something that, if you remember, right after the financial crisis hit, he had actually been Ronald Reagan's, Martin Feldstein had an article in the Wall Street Journal saying we have to get housing prices back up. If we allow those prices to collapse, we're going to see the economy going down. The key to keeping the economy going is to keep housing prices up. Well, how do you do that? All right. How do you do that when the institutions that have been involved in this find that these investments are bad? People cannot make their house payments. All right. What do we do when people can't make the payments? Ooh, okay. You just keep lending money? What do you do? And so, you know, these folks were off in left field someplace. All right. And so, what happened? Okay, you had the government did not allow the malinvestment to go. Yeah, housing developments went. I mean, developers took it on the chin. People who had to walk away from the houses took it on the chin. So, I mean, there were a lot of people who did it. The banks themselves were bailed out. Why? Because they feared bank runs. They feared that we could see another return of the bank runs of the early 1930s, in which I think close to half the banks in the United States collapsed. But I think that that what we've seen, though, has been massive intervention and all sorts of things. And also with this particular administration throwing huge amounts of money into green energy, which is not at all profitable, trying to force people to you know, making things more costly, making it more difficult to start businesses. Obamacare, oh my gosh. I mean, think of all of the disincentives of Obamacare. And you talk about, I mean, would you invest in that situation, knowing you've got this bomb waiting? What kind of capital investment would you do? Let's say you've got a mid-sized firm, but you know if you get above 49 employees, you're going to be in trouble. All right? And so, therefore, do you invest long-term and increase the size and scope of your business, or you just try to keep things where they are? All right? You try to maintain. You certainly don't want to have to hire anybody else, okay? Think of all these disincentives, all of these things that have come about since then. And Krugman says are good because government's spending more money. What he said about green energy. Look, they're spending money, and that's what the economy needs right now. All right? In other words, that a subsidized business somehow is making the economy wealthy and making us better. In other words, you know, it's cannibalizing, taking it from the healthy sectors and transferring it to the weaker sectors. And that's one of the things that we've seen. Okay, we've seen this real transfer of wealth from those entities that are healthy. Now, you've got some situations, for example, you've got the oil booms that are going on right now, thanks to, you know, to fracking, and there's a lot of resistance. You know, like, for example, where I live in Maryland, we have a governor who has presidential ambitions. Now, I'm in the mountains, all right? I'm actually in Frostburg looking at snow on the ground here. We're at about 2,000 feet. My home is at about 2,600 feet in Garrett County. And you don't think of Maryland that way, but at any rate, in this western portion would be a lot of natural gas that could be gotten through the drill called fracking. Okay, now there are some issues with fracking, and I'm not openly endorsing it, but what I'm saying is that it has been a real boom in western Pennsylvania where they've been doing it, and people have been found work. It's been a source of real live employment, not subsidized, but real live employment and wealth and the like. And it's also contributed to lower natural gas prices, which has also been good for the United States. But Maryland and where I live, this is a depressed area. People are moving away. People cannot find work, and so they go elsewhere. The governor, he's got appeal to the environmentalists, and they will not allow it at all. Same way in New York, Andrew Cuomo has presidential aspirations, and so he's making sure that the upper counties in New York, which, you know, have been a lot of really depressed regions in New York, I mean, really are. And again, these are counties that are being emptied out because people, you know, they can't find work. They're not sustaining themselves. And in both situations, I would add that they're both governors are Democratic. The voting patterns in these counties generally tend to be Republican. That's another way. It's just basically politicians screwing people who don't vote for them, all right, which would be par for the course. Now, I don't want to get too far. What I'm saying is that there are lines of investment that would be profitable here. But overall, we've got a government that discourages that, all right, and looks for ways to pin costs on people. And so what happens? People don't invest in them. I, you know, And I asked even the liberals here, I said, would you invest in a business in Maryland? Well, especially a capital intensive business. You know, heck no, I wouldn't do that. No, I mean, wouldn't, you know, you'd be in trouble. All right. And so I think that that's something else to keep in mind. I want to, you know, so really the Keynesians argue about interfering. So we really are on different sides of the fence, okay? The very things that Keynesians advocate are very things we say often, say we prolong the economic misery, okay? All right, now it's intuitive, right? The Keynesians say, hey, what we see a lack of demand. We've got to increase demand, okay? But that's not what happens, okay? Austrians look at the economy, the real factors. What are the factors of production that are going to be involved in the production of things that consumers want? That's where the investment should go. But, you know, unfortunately, we're not winning that argument right now. We're not winning it because we have bad ideas. We're winning it because, you know, statism is a very, very powerful force, okay, and it has a lot of friends. And so I think that's, you know, that's where we are. All right, because I see it's 6:56. All right, any questions before we leave? Pam, you have any comments or anything that I should remember? I think next week is our last one. I will have the 10 question quiz for you. It's in the day, and then I'll get everything else ready. So yeah, next week will be the last that we do. So I will see you. Let me see. Got a couple questions and along. Yeah, thank you. Okay, yeah, appreciate that, John, very much. And agreed. Mike, I absolutely agree with you too. Well, long run, we're all dead, and unfortunately, we have a government that's trying to make us dead a little more quicker than before. All right. Any other questions or comments or anything? Mm-hmm. Okay, then I will see you next week. And thanks again to Danny Sanchez and to Pam. Is it Ray or Rita? I want to make sure I pronounce it correctly. Ray, Cam Ray, it's what I thought. Okay. And to both, to both of you, thank you very much for your help and everything that you're doing. All right, guys, I will see you next week. Same bat time, same bat station. All right.